Welcome once again into the Radiopedia Reading Room, a podcast unconcerned with books or poetry, tea leaves or palmistry. It's a radiology podcast. My name is Andrew Dixon. That was a traditional intro, unchanged. And joining me, looking so smug because he's recorded today's main segment. And so that makes two out of the last three episodes. That's unheard of. It's my co-host, Frank Gaylard.
I know, right? Actual proper bespoke content just for you, Dixon.
Delivered on a platter. So you bring the new content thoroughly prepared over months. And you know what I'll bring? I'll bring my thoughtless YouTuber reactions. So it's a readful episode that you have for us here. You're reading the Radiopedia article on spontaneous intracranial hypotension to neuroradiologist from Guy's and St. Thomas's Hospital in London and expert on CSF leaks, Dr. Lalani Carlton-Jones.
She is, and it's a big topic. So despite my best efforts, it's a long one. Mm-hmm. And that is after editing it down to about half the length of the conversation we actually had. And I have to say, Dixon, I really enjoy preparing readfuls or interviews. Mm-hmm. I particularly enjoy actually recording them, but I despise editing them afterwards. Really despise it. So if you want me to do more of these, you're going to have to find some help for me, I think.
Yeah, I mean, you need help in more ways than one, mate, but I'm hearing you. It does take a long time. Perhaps there's a really keen listener out there who wants to volunteer to edit main segments for us. You never know.
That we would have be some amazing. Unique listeners. That would be amazing. So, yes, if you are keen, please get in touch at podcast@radiopedia.org. I would definitely do more of these if we had someone to help out.
All right. Well, let's see if we can get that for you. But despite how long it took you to record and edit this one, Gaylard, I must say I'm really looking forward to listening to this topic. Let's get straight to it. This is Frank Gaylard reading the Radiopedia article on spontaneous intracranial hypotension to Lalani Carlton-Jones. And after we listen to that, I'll be back to share my almost certainly poorly informed and poorly formed reactions in the outro.
Hello and welcome, Lal.
Hi, Frank. It's a pleasure to be here.
Oh, boy, this has taken us quite a while to organize, in part because when I first brought this up as a topic idea with you, you informed me that the content on Radiopedia was woefully outdated. And so we've spent the last few months reading and rewriting the content. For you, this must have been easy because I know you are heavily involved in this topic and very well read and published. For me, this was something I really missed. And so I've learnt a lot just in the process of getting ready for this.
Yeah, things have changed rapidly in this field over the last decade and even more so in the last few years alone and are still rapidly changing. So we're going to have to keep updating this article, I think, pretty frequently.
Okay, so the way this is going to work is I'm going to read from the Radiopedia article on spontaneous intracranial hypotension as it was mid-February 2024, which is worth mentioning because this is a rapidly evolving topic. And then after each section, we can have a quick chat about what we've just spoken about. Does that sound good?
Yep, great. Let's go for it.
Okay, let's start with the introduction. Intracranial hypotension, also known as craniospinal hypotension, is a clinical entity that results from a cerebrospinal fluid leak that almost without exception occurs from the spine, either into the epidural space or directly into veins in the setting of CSF venous fistulas. It usually, but not invariably, presents clinically with orthostatic headaches. Diagnosis of the leak and treatment are challenging and rely on multimodality imaging.
Yeah, this is a pretty good introduction. It sets the scene for the basis of what we're going to be discussing today, namely that these are leaks in the spine below the skull base, and we don't always see CSF when we do MRI of the spine.
Let's kick on to the terminology section, which it always sounds a bit dry, but actually I'm finding that this is one of the most important parts of all our articles because often terminology has drifted or changed in meaning over the years. And so when you're reading older literature, it can become confusing as to what we're talking about. So the terminology section goes as follows. As understanding of CSF dynamics and the pathophysiology of CSF leaks has evolved, the terminology has become somewhat confusing. Intracranial hypotension can broadly be divided into primary, usually referred to as spontaneous intracranial hypotension, or secondary, iatrogenic, lumbar puncture or surgery, overshunting due to diversion devices, or traumatic. Importantly, not all types of CSF leak produce intracranial hypotension. In particular, with the exception of rare case reports, skull-based CSF leaks almost never result in the clinical syndrome of intracranial hypotension. The reasons for this are complicated but are related to whether a leak occurs above or below the hydrostatic indifference point, which is usually located in the low cervical or upper thoracic spine. Similarly, middle cranial fossa meningocele seen in patients with underlying idiopathic intracranial hypertension do not usually manifest with clinical or imaging features of intracranial hypotension.
Let's go a little bit into the hydrostatic indifference point so people understand this. So this is the level in the spine where CSF pressure is the same lying and standing, and it's normally found in the lower cervical spine. So when you stand, the pressure above this point falls and the pressure below this point increases. So the pressure in your head is less when you stand than when you lie down. And that's normal. But the drop is normally only a little. And so you're not symptomatic from this. The further above this point somewhere is, the more the pressure falls. Now, when you have a spinal leak, the indifference point moves towards the leak site. So with a thoracic leak, which is where most of these leaks occur, the indifference point moves downwards. This means the head is now further away from it. And when the patient stands, the pressure drop is even greater than normal, enough to cause symptoms. Now, with a cranial leak or a skull-based leak, the hydrostatic indifference point moves up slightly. So even though there is less CSF volume and the pressure within the system is less as a result, when the patient stands, there is less of a drop in intracranial pressure than normal because the head is now closer to that hydrostatic indifference point. And so this counteracts the effect of there being less CSF and symptoms of low intracranial pressure do not occur. So in summary, spinal CSF leaks cause hypotension, but skull-based leaks don't.
Yeah, and that was a really important change in how I understood things reading through it, because not only is it a big change, it also means that you don't go down false investigation pathways for patients that have intracranial hypotension. And whether or not the hydrostatic indifference point theory gets proven categorically, the idea that leaks occur when there is a positive pressure in the CSF at all times, especially when you're standing, really makes sense as to why these occur in the spine. Because when you're standing, the pressure of the CSF is so much lower intracranially that there's not as much of a reason for CSF to leak out from the base of skull. And also explains why it's when people bend over that they get CSF leaks typically, because or when they strain, because the pressure then pushes CSF out. So let's move on to epidemiology. Spontaneous intracranial hypotension is typically encountered in middle-aged, 30 to 50 years of age, and has a predilection for women, female-to-male ratio of 2 to 1. Of interest, this is a similar demographic to idiopathic intracranial hypertension, which is believed to be an unrecognized predisposing factor. Epidemiology of secondary intracranial hypotension is variable and matches that of the underlying cause.
When you're thinking about your patient with spinal CSF leak and they've got findings on their brain MRI, you can just take a pause here and just look at the age of your patient. And by and large, you will be able to guess what kind of spinal leak they're going to get. So younger patients in general will get a type 1, which is a dural tear type leak, or a type 2 lateral leak. By and large, CSF venous fistulas occur in a slightly middle to older age population. And there is an association between connective tissue disorders and CSF venous fistulas, as well as an underlying idiopathic intracranial hypertension or a raised spinal pressure decompressing through spinal leak.
Okay, let's move on to clinical presentation. The condition often presents as a postural or orthostatic headache, which is relieved by lying in a recumbent position, usually within 15 to 30 minutes. This is, however, not always the case, and the orthostatic quality of the headache may subside in the long term. Some patients have headaches that are not relieved by lying down. Others have headaches that develop slowly during the course of the day, so-called second half of day headaches, or are precipitated by the Valsalva maneuver. Other symptoms include nausea, vomiting, neck pain, visual and hearing disturbances, including tinnitus and vertigo. Occasionally, the clinical presentation is more sinister, with frontotemporal brain sagging syndrome. In this phenotype, patients present with a progressive cognitive impairment mimicking behavioral variant of frontotemporal lobar degeneration and may have decreased level of consciousness and coma and may have ataxia or Parkinsonism. Another uncommon manifestation and potentially masking the underlying presence of hypotension is the development of cerebral venous thrombosis, said to occur in approximately 2% of cases of intracranial hypotension.
As you've said, the majority of these patients will present with an orthostatic headache, but just be careful that this can go over time and particularly following treatment. I think it is important to think about venous sinus thrombosis. It is a known association with this condition. I mean, it's in larger series meant to be around 1% to 2%. We're not really sure why that occurs. It may be because of venous stasis, stretching vessels.
It certainly seems to make sense, doesn't it? Because when you look at these studies, the veins are so engorged.
Yeah.
And cerebral blood flow is not going to have increased. Therefore, that venous blood has to be moving more slowly. And what about this frontotemporal brain sagging syndrome?
Yeah, this is an incredibly important cohort. I don't think it's that uncommon. I think that a lot of patients who have SIH have some cognitive impairment or some cognitive slowing, but particularly this cohort, they have very marked brain sag. And I think this is really important to pick up because it's often misdiagnosed, there's often delay in diagnosis, but incredibly rewarding if you find the underlying cause, which is usually a CSF venous fistula, and then treat it because this is a reversible and curable cause of dementia.
The thing that really struck me reading through the literature on this particular topic is just how many patients that are reported before the discovery, if you want, or description of CSF venous fistulas, and how obviously these patients just gradually succumbed to something that potentially was treatable. And clinicians were just trying whatever they could. They were giving steroids, they were doing lots of epidural blood patches, and patients just got worse.
Indeed. I think this is incredibly important, and often, you know, to bear in mind that often these patients don't have headache. They often don't have many of the other imaging findings of hypotension. It's usually just brain sac and maybe a bit of dural enhancement, but really not much else. But as the radiologists, we're therefore key in often picking up these patients and alerting the clinicians that this can be treated.
Okay, let's move on to diagnosis. The International Classification of Headache Disorders, 3rd edition, ICHD-3, criteria for the headache attributed to low CSF pressure are: A, any headache fulfilling criterion C. That's probably something that if you're really interested in the criteria, you're better off reading.
Yeah, I mean, neurologists love criteria, don't they?
We were talking with Andrew about what we listen to when we want to go to sleep. And whether it's audiobooks or music. And I think maybe Radiopedia could collaborate with the International Classification of Headache Disorders 3rd edition to bring out an audio version of it. And you can just pop on some of these criteria. Do you listen to audiobooks when you need to go to sleep, or white noise or something else?
I do. I hope you're not suggesting that you're going to listen to this when you go to sleep.
No. We wake people up too much. What sort of things do you listen to? Are you a Stephen Fry kind of?
I'm mainly into like podcasts, actually. I'm really into Radiolab.
Oh, I love Radiolab.
Radiolab?
Yes. They're the OG, the original gangsters.
The OG.
All right. Sorry. Moving on to diagnosis.
That's going to be edited out of this, right?
Sure. Yep. Now, back to the diagnosis. It should be noted that most patients with spontaneous intracranial hypotension do not, in fact, have low opening pressures at lumbar puncture. In one study, only 34% of patients had pressures below 6 centimeters of water, while the opening pressure was between 6 and 20 centimeters in 61% and was even greater than 20 centimeters in the remaining 5%. The use of lumbar puncture solely to measure opening pressure as a diagnostic tool in suspected spontaneous intracranial hypotension is therefore discouraged, but opening pressure can be measured at the time an LP is performed during myelography.
I think opening pressure is pretty useless, actually, as a diagnostic tool. And I would counsel clinicians not to do this because, as people who are involved in trying not to create more leaks, don't puncture the dura until you have to. You don't want to be involved in creating another problem. Do I think that an opening pressure measurement is at all useful? Okay, I do sometimes. For patients who I think have CSF venous fistulas, I'm going to know that. We're going to go into the imaging of that in a bit. I look at the pressure because I always pressurize my patients before myelography. I think it massively picks up your CSF venous fistula pickup rate, and I judge how much I pressurize by what the opening pressure is.
And by pressurize, you mean?
Instill. I usually use intrathecal normal saline, yep. warmed normal saline. Other people have used Elliott's B, things that are CSF equivalent.
All right, let's move on to the pathology here. We're starting to get into the real meat of the topic. Intracranial hypotension results from a CSF leak somewhere along the neuraxis, usually below the hydrostatic indifference points, and leads to alterations in the equilibrium between the volumes of intracranial blood, CSF, and brain tissue, the Munro-Keeley hypothesis. A decrease in CSF volume leads to compensatory dilatation of the vascular spaces, mostly the venous side, due to its higher compliance. Now, for those of you not familiar with Munro-Keeley hypothesis, this goes back to when I was a neurosurgery registrar. It has its own article, but I thought I'd just briefly touch on it. It's a simple concept, but it's really at the heart of the imaging manifestations of changes in intracranial pressure. And basically, it sets up the idea that the skull and spine are a fixed, rigid volume that's filled with various liquid and squishy bits, namely brain, CSF, and blood. And that if you change the volume of one of those components, you have to change the volume of the others if you want to maintain a normal pressure. And in the case of CSF leaks, if you reduce the CSF, you're not going to really increase your brain volume, although there is brain swelling to a degree. What you particularly increase is the venous side that expands. And that's the dominant feature that you can see on imaging, as we'll get to.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think having that concept in mind really helps you understand the imaging features that we see.
Okay, so etiology. Spontaneous intracranial hypotension is usually the result of a CSF leak in the spine. Spontaneous leaks have been classified into four types and include multiple causes. Type 1, the dural tear, is most often ventral and thoracic. When ventral, mostly occurs in the upper thoracic spine and typically related to calcified disc protrusions, and are responsible for around 40% of cases. Type 2, a lateral leak, associated with a meningeal diverticulum that protrudes through a defect in the nerve root sleeve or its axilla, and most occur in the lower thoracic region. And these are responsible for around 17% of cases. Type 3, CSF venous fistulas, most are associated with a meningeal diverticulum and most occur in the thoracic spine. And they're responsible for around 23% of cases, although these are increasingly recognized and this is likely an underestimate. And type 4, the distal nerve root sleeve leak, due to a congenital focal absence of the dura, the so-called nude nerve root, and these are rare. Despite advances in imaging of patients with spontaneous intracranial hypotension, in a significant minority, around 19%, the cause remains elusive.
I think it's great that we've got this etiology down now, and you can see that kind of knowing generally where these leaks occur can also help you when you want to try and identify them. As you said, there's increasing recognition of CSF venous fistula. That 23% is likely to be a pretty fast underestimate. We see this all the time now. It still blows my mind that I think that 10 years ago, we had patients who were floridly imaging positive on their brain. They had all the findings and people just couldn't see anything on their spine. And, you know, these patients all had CSF venous fistulas and we just didn't know what was causing it.
Onto radiographic features. Imaging is crucial both in confirming the diagnosis of intracranial hypotension and identifying the location of the leak. CT. Described features of intracranial hypotension include subdural collections, acquired tonsillar ectopia, dural venous sinus distension, and the layer cake sign, diffuse layered calvarial hyperostosis, seen in 14 to 32% of patients.
So listen, CT head is often the first examination that these patients will have in the emergency department. It is harder to pick up intracranial hypotension on CT head, but it's not impossible. And I've seen lots of great radiologists who pick this up. If you see a patient who has spontaneous headache and subdural collections, even if there's a minor trauma, think about SIH. If you just want to send the patient for the MR to confirm it, fine. But also, reformat your images in the sagittal plane. You usually see brain sag on that. Usually the other findings too, venous distension, pituitary distension, and you might be the first person to call this. I would also say that if you have a patient with bilateral subdurals, even in minor trauma, think about SIH again. You don't see brain sag as a result of Mass Effect. We miss a lot of these. Neurosurgeons drill a lot of these. 50% of these patients will get worse because you're not treating the problem that's caused their subdurals in the first place.
Oh, that's really important. Okay, now we're going to get onto MRI, Lal, and this is pretty long, so I want you to feel free to jump in at any point with any comments you have. MRI. The most common qualitative finding is pachymeningeal thickening and enhancement, followed by dural venous engorgement, tonsillar herniation, and subdural collections. However, these features are not always present, which is why quantitative findings are very helpful in making a more accurate diagnosis on MRI. Qualitative signs. Pachymeningeal enhancement is the most common finding and becomes less prevalent over time after the onset of symptoms, hence in patients with a chronic duration of symptoms in whom clinically the headache pattern also changes from orthostatic to atypical constant headache, the absence of dural enhancement may hinder the diagnosis of intracranial hypotension.
You don't always need to give contrast to see this. What you're looking for is pachymeningeal thickening. That's the underlying process. But you will more easily spot this by giving GAD.
Yes. I think it shows up really well on flare, but it's easy to overlook if you're not used to staring at them.
Yes, indeed.
Okay, the next one is increased venous blood volume, venous distension sign or rounding of the cross-section of the dural venous sinuses, prominence of inferior intercavernous sinus. Intracranial venous thrombosis is a well-recognized, albeit uncommon, complication. I just want to jump in with that pituitary sign because I think this is something that most or many trainees at least aren't aware of, that the intercavernous sinus that runs below the pituitary gland is usually collapsed in normal physiology. But when distended in sagittal projection, it can appear like a little rounded lesion.
Quite.
And look like a microadenoma. Yeah. And I've seen a couple that have been called that. The next one is enlargement of the pituitary gland as a result of pituitary hyperemia, subdural effusions and eventual subdural hematomas, diffuse cerebral edema, and reduced CSF volume resulting in sagging brainstem and acquired tonsillar ectopia.
I think it's important to note here that we don't really know why brain sag occurs and that there are varying degrees of it. So you get very marked degrees of it in like the brain sagging dementia syndrome, and in other patients you may not see it that well at all. And we can look for quantitative measurements of that that can help us, which we'll talk about shortly. The important thing here is not to misdiagnose a Chiari with this, okay? And Chiari is a tonsillar problem. In SIH, you have a whole brainstem problem, particularly the midbrain is abnormal.
I've seen a couple of patients that have gone all the way to posterior fossa decompression.
Me too.
For Chiari, and it's disastrous. Yeah. All right, the other findings are layer cake skull due to chronic calvarial hyperemia, infratentorial superficial siderosis. Although not a sign of intracranial hypotension per se, the presence of this finding is strongly suggestive of a spinal CSF leak from a dural defect in the spine. And quantitative signs, and these are, you know, I always worry about using rulers, but I think it is very helpful to just force yourself to look at these regions. And the quantitative signs are mammillopontine distance of less than 6.5 millimeters, pontomesencephalic angle, less than 50 degrees, interpeduncular angle, less than 40.5 degrees.
These measurements are taken from papers where they looked, you know, specifically for reference ranges of these signs to help differentiate, for example, Chiari versus SIH. So if you're thinking about you're not sure with those things, then you may find them useful. I personally don't get out a measuring tool for this.
Yeah, I think it's like staging criteria, et cetera. Knowing that they exist helps you guide your attention when you're interpreting images.
Yeah, we've mentioned a lot of these signs, but I want to counsel radiologists that you don't have to have all of these signs to make the diagnosis of hypotension. Only some of these may be present. And it's really important that brain imaging may be normal in spite of ongoing CSF leak. It's pretty well known that imaging findings normalize over time and particularly following, for example, epidural blood patching. So if they're coming to you as a tertiary center, you really want to look back to that initial imaging.
Right, that's really important. Okay, now imaging strategy. This, I think, is probably the most important part of this article because it's probably the one that, unless you're in one of the few centers that is fully on board with this, is where your practice most likely diverges from what the current best practices are. So identifying the site of CSF leakage can be challenging, especially in spontaneous cases, and embarking upon imaging can be daunting as the leak can be located anywhere along the neuraxis, although usually in the spine, and leaks can vary dramatically in their rate, ranging from large volume rapid leaks to slow leaks to intermittent or inapparent leaks, or those where the connection is directly into the venous system, CSF venous fistula, which therefore have no pooling of CSF. As a result, no single examination is guaranteed to confirm and localize the abnormality. As understanding, technology, and techniques have evolved, so too have recommended imaging strategies. These will also depend on local expertise. Generally, the approach should consist of 1. Confirming the presence of intracranial hypertension, 2. Confirming the presence of CSF leak, and 3. Identifying the specific location and cause of CSF leak. Depending on the cause and location, these may all be achieved on the first study or require a number of different studies.
Yeah, I think it's very unlikely you're going to achieve this on one study. This is going to be a combination of MRI brain, MRI spine, and then myelographic technique.
Okay, so let's start with MRI brain, preferably with contrast. MRI brain is an essential first step to look for imaging findings that support the diagnosis of intracranial hypotension and also to rule out other unexpected pathology. It also enables the calculation of the burn score, a predictive score that stratifies patients into high, intermediate, or low probability of finding a spinal CSF leak or CSF venous fistula at myelography. This in turn can help further guide investigations.
So we mentioned what the MRI brain findings were earlier, and I would just encourage radiologists to report what we've described to you. We do mention burn scores in reports sometimes, but I just want to make this clear. This is the likelihood of finding a CSF leak at myelography. It is not used to diagnose hypotension. And it's still pretty subjective.
So just to sort of round this off so you don't need to go look it up, the burn score divides into major and minor criteria, and you get 2 points for each major criteria and 1 point for each minor criteria. It's not actually that complicated. The major criteria are pachymeningeal enhancement, engorgement of the dural venous sinuses, and a supracellar cistern of 4 millimeters or less. And the minor criteria, 1 point each, are subdural fluid collections, prepontine cistern of 5 millimeters or less, and mamillopontine distance of 6.5 millimeters or less. And so you give some points, and the interpretation is the higher the point, the higher the probability of identifying a CSF leak. 0 to 2 is low probability and you're unlikely to find a leak. 3 to 4 is intermediate probability. But most importantly, and this I think is where it's helpful, is when you are 5 or above, then the probability of eventually finding a leak, if you persist, is somewhere in the order of, 67 to 100%. And I think that's important because it is tempting to give up and it is tempting to not okay the next radiation-containing test because often these patients are quite young. But if you do have a high burn score, then you really should pursue the diagnosis aggressively in the knowledge that the literature supports you doing so.
I completely agree with that, Frank. When patients have high burn scores, we know they've got a leak, we've got to find it and treat that appropriately.
Okay, MRI spine. Ideally, this could be performed at the same time as the MRI of the brain, but need not consist of a full multi-parameter study. Heavily T2 weighted fat saturated sequences through the spinal canal and adjacent soft tissues suffice. These can be performed as a 3D sequence, ideally, or multiplanar 2D sequences. The purposes of the MRI of the spine is not to localize the site of the leak. This is seldom possible by non-invasive means, but rather to determine the most likely type of spinal CSF leak the patient has based on the presence or absence of epidural fluid. This then determines what type of myelography to perform in order to localize the leak. When epidural fluid is shown on MRI, a so-called wet leak, then a dural defect and a type 1 or 2 leak is present. In the absence of epidural leak, so-called a dry leak, a CSF venous fistula is most likely to be the cause, or rarely a far lateral nerve root sleeve tear.
I would say that when we do MRI brain and MRI spine, these can be long examinations. Think about why you're doing it. We're doing it to help us perform the next diagnostic and treatment strategy, and therefore you can do a limited protocol.
If further localization of a leak is required, then a variety of myelographic techniques are useful, which is chosen depending on what the initial imaging of the brain and spine have shown, as well as on local preference, policies, and available equipment and expertise. There are five main options, each with pros and cons. Dynamic CT myelography, prone or decubitus, digital subtraction myelography, fluoroscopic myelography, MR myelography, and nuclear medicine myelography.
These are five main options, but I would say that the top two, dynamic CT myelography and digital subtraction myelography, are probably the main workhorses in CSF leak. And really, there is no one is better than the other. The best method is the one that you are comfortable with, the one that you have access to. A lot of people don't have access to CT scanners for intervention. A lot of people don't have access to the angio suite if they want to do DSM. And the one that you gain success at, because there is a learning curve to these myelograms, but once you start to get successful at them, you will refine that technique. For me, this is dynamic CTM. I do use some fluoroscopic and DSM-based techniques, but I use them actually rarely. I love dynamic CTM. We're really successful with this, and we actually are able to keep our doses pretty low through a variety of techniques.
Excellent. Okay, so that actually brings us to dynamic CT myelography. Unlike traditional CT myelography, where intrathecal contrast is introduced a significant time prior to the CT, often in the fluoroscopy room, allowing the contrast to mix evenly throughout the CSF, in dynamic CT myelography, contrast is introduced with the patient already positioned in the CT scanner, either prone or in lateral decubitus position, depending on the likely cause of CSF leak, and dense contrast visualized to identify the site of leakage. This usually requires multiple acquisitions and thus can have high radiation doses. Dynamic CT myelography is highly sensitive for the detection of ventral leaks or for dural tears, lateral leaks from nerve root sleeves, and CSF venous fissures. It should be noted that if the amount of leak CSF is large, the distribution of fluid should not be interpreted as necessarily representing the site of leak. CSF in the epidural space may migrate over significant distances and pool depending on the patient position and anatomy. Similarly, delayed myelography will show a pacification of the entire epidural fluid collection and may misrepresent the site of leak. A particular example of this pooling of contrast, or CSF, is at the C1-2 level posteriorly. This can be incorrectly attributed to a local leak, when in fact this is not the case. This is referred to as a false localizing sign. There's a lot in there. Can you walk us through any of the important points?
Yeah, I think the most important take-home points of dynamic CTM. I mean, dynamic CTM means that there's something changing about the CT capture when you're injecting the contrast. And I want to reiterate this point. There is no role for injecting contrast in the fluoro room and then bringing the patient around to CT. You're not going to pick up leaks or localize them that way. You have to do it on the table in CT. Okay, it has to be, you know, scanning immediately. And you will have already got a clue to what is your type of leak from your MRI. If there's fluid, you know it's going to be a fast leak, a dural tear type leak. And then you position your patient depending on where that fluid is on the MRI, whether you think it's going to be a lateral leak or a ventral leak. And then we're just looking for the fluid escaping in real time. If there's no fluid on the MRI, we're going to do decubitus CT myelography, so both right and left sides, to look for a CSF venous fistula. And I think, you know, having that MRI already tailor your dynamic CT myelography strategy is really important.
All right, digital subtraction myelography. Digital subtraction myelography has the best temporal resolution, and with newer equipment allowing Dyna CT can also obtain cross-sectional images. This is particularly useful for CSF venous fistulas. The size of the detector limits the field of view that can be examined and is typically necessary to undertake two separate digital subtraction myelographic runs of the cervical and upper thoracic spine and the lower thoracic and upper lumbar spine to ensure adequate coverage. A further limitation is the decreased visibility of the upper thoracic spine, where most type 1 leaks occur due to difficulty of beam penetration through the overlying shoulders.
So yeah, I think, you know, digital subtraction myelography in experienced hands can be really successful. I think it's important that if you're doing these patients under local anesthetic, you have to counsel your patients because this technique is very artifact prone from breathing and movement, and it can really degrade your DSM. Some flickering because of that can look like a little vein. And I think for the large draining paraspinal veins, DSM is very good. But for really small internal epidural plexus venous fistulas or some of the smaller CSF venous fistulas, it can be very difficult on this. You know, some centers do this under sedation or general anesthetic. I mean, it does have very good temporal resolution. So if you're querying something on CTM, you know, you could always take them for a focused digital subtraction myelography to look at that further.
Okay, fluoroscopic myelography. Conventional fluoroscopic myelography uses real-time fluoroscopic tracking of a bolus of contrast medium injected at the lumbar puncture and moved along the spine by means of incremental head-down tilting of the table. This has the advantage of excellent temporal resolution, limited only by the frame rate of the fluoroscopic acquisition, but superimposition of bony structures can limit the sensitivity for leaks, especially in the upper thoracic spine. MR myelography. MR myelography with intrathecal gadolinium is not approved by the FDA and is associated with neurotoxicity, particularly if renal function or CSF hydrodynamics are compromised. But it has been tried in some cases when other methods have failed to demonstrate the source of CSF leak.
Yeah, so obviously, again, I'm going to reiterate, this is an off-license indication, so you must counsel the patient about that. If you're going to do this, you have to give a really small dose of GAD. It's like 0.5 mils. Don't inject any more than that because you can create an encephalopathy. I've done this a few times when we haven't been able to find the source of leak, and we haven't found it useful yet because I think MR is very prone to artifact. Mm-hmm. I think there are some centers that are working on this with refinement. This could be a good avenue in the future, and it may have some utility in slow leak.
And the last one is nuclear medicine myelography. Nuclear medicine myelography can also be employed using intrathecal indium DTPA with images obtained typically at 1, 2, 4, and 24 hours, and in some instances, even 48 hours post-injection. Localization can be seen as a focal accumulation of activity, in some cases, only indirect evidence of leak being present somewhere is available, which is only really useful in instances where the diagnosis of CSF leak remains uncertain. Indirect evidence includes early accumulation of activity within the urinary tract, kidneys and bladder at 4 hours, absent activity over the cerebral convexities at 24 hours, rapid loss of activity from within the CSF space.
So I think it's important that we wouldn't use this for localization of leaks because it is really quite low resolution. Not many people are using this at the moment, even for diagnosis, because all the diagnostic methods are pretty good. But in the patients who maybe have imaging negative, very low burn score, if we really want to say, like you said, do they have, you know, a CSF leak, then this might have some use.
All right, we're getting to the end here. Treatment and prognosis. A non-targeted epidural blood patch is often used in cases of spontaneous intracranial hypotension on the assumption that the leak is from the spine, with variable success. When successful, headaches resolve within 72 hours of intervention. Subdural effusions can resolve within a few days to weeks. Larger subdural collections often require far longer to resolve.
Now, non-targeted epidural blood patch, you know, how does this work? And the answer is, we don't really know, but it is almost certainly not sealing a site of leak in patients with spontaneous intracranial hypotension. It has a lot more to do with what it does to fecal compliance and what it does to the hydrostatic indifference point and how it is changing the pressures and allowing the body's own mechanisms to heal, for example, the dural defect. I still think that epidural blood patch, when performed at high volume, is a good first-line management in acute leaks and definitely for patients who are decompensating, who are dropping their GCS. But personally, I think the most important thing about this is that for fistula-type leaks, it does have limited success in these long-term, but I would still counsel district general hospitals or hospitals where they don't have tertiary capabilities for workup of leaks, that an epidural blood patch will usually help symptomatically, even in fistula-type leaks. For fast leaks, it almost certainly has value in getting the patient out of low pressure. That doesn't mean it's going to seal the dural defect. One of the things that is really important is don't just do a blood patch for your patient and then leave them alone. because most of these patients will improve symptomatically. They may even think they've gone back to normal. If there is fluid still in the spine, epidural fluid, that patient is at a significant long-term risk of superficial siderosis. You are duty-bound to follow the patient up.
That's a really important point, because CNS siderosis is irreversible. When you've got your deafness or your cranial nerve dysfunction or your bulbar symptoms, that's it. The most you can hope for is stopping symptom progression. And even then, once you've got that much hemosiderin, symptoms can progress even once you treat it.
Exactly. We're going to see lots more of this, because think about how many patients get epidural blood patches and then we just don't hear about them again. We need to make sure that fluid goes in these patients. The evidence that is out there, probably anywhere between a 50 to a 90% risk that you will develop siderosis. I just want to mention this briefly because people probably be thinking, what on earth has siderosis got to do with a spinal CSF leak? And the answer is, we don't really know for sure. But if you have a defect that is a chronic dural defect, it may be that you have bleeding from the epidural veins crossing through that defect, or it may be that there's a microangiopathy at the margins of that defect over time, which leads to venous ooze into the CSF, because we almost exclusively see this with dural tear type leak. There are some reports of it occurring with CSF venous fistulas as well. Maybe that's some retrograde flow from the vein into the CSF space, but it's mostly with dural tear type leaks that are untreated.
And you also see it in pseudomeningocele.
Yes.
Like not in this context, but in the post-operative. And that kind of makes sense, because a pseudomeningocele will be lined by a granulation tissue that is leaky and red blood cells will leak out.
Yeah, most of these patients don't have any hypotension symptoms anymore. You know, and actually when you speak to most of them and you ask them about the history 20 years ago, most of them will give you a hypotension history, whether it was treated with a patch or whether it was completely not treated. That's usually the case. So I would say if you see siderosis, you need to image the spine. It's most often going to be, there's going to be a collection there. And we've seen these be really tiny, like really tiny, but it's going to be there. You just got to find it.
Okay, so let's move on. In cases where such speculative treatment fails, localization of the CSF leak is required, allowing for targeted treatment according to leak type. Type 1 dural tears, targeted epidural blood or fibrin glue patch or surgery. Type 2 lateral leaks, targeted epidural blood or fibrin glue patch or surgery. And type 3 CSF venous fistulas, targeted fibrin glue patch, transvenous embolization or surgery. Targeted epidural or fibrin glue patches for ventral dural leaks can either be performed using a translaminar approach, as for initial non-targeted injection, or aimed at entering the ventral epidural space using a transforaminal approach at one or more levels and potentially from both sides. For lateral dural leaks from nerve root sleeves or meningeal diverticula, a transforaminal approach can be used to target the dural defect. For CSF venous fistulas, a good clinical response to fibrin glue is more likely when the spread of injectate is concordant with the locations of draining veins of the fistula, as shown by myelography.
Yeah, so a lot of different treatments here. And did you notice how many of these can be performed by radiologists? Pretty much all of them. And, you know, we can perform a stepwise escalation to the different types of treatment according to how the patient responds. And when we're doing targeted patching, this has a different mechanism of action to when we're doing non-targeted patching, because we're aiming for a direct sealant effect across a site of leak or within the leak. Type 1 leaks, we patch with glue and blood. If acute, if chronic, we tend to send more of these to surgery, but we are doing more work with how we actually get into these collections, because chronic membranes are formed. So we really need to be within that to get a proper seal across the defect. Type 2 leaks are really good for CT-guided glue patching. I did one of these today and they respond really well. I've had probably 15 or 16 lateral leaks. We've only had to send one to surgery. And type 3 leaks, we go for a CT-guided fibrin occlusion first. And we might try to repeat that again. And we're pretty successful with that, 70%. And the literature mirrors that as well. And then we can escalate to a transvenous embolization if that doesn't work, and surgical ligation as a last resort.
Well, that's it, Lau. We've made it. That was a really interesting talk. Any parting thoughts before we wrap up?
So as you can see, it's a huge topic, right?
Yes.
But it's one in which the radiologist plays a really central role. And it's not rare. It's at least as half as common as subarachnoid hemorrhage. And it's probably more common than that because it's underdiagnosed and misdiagnosed all the time. Think about it in the patient with spontaneous headache. And if you're in doubt, just get some MRI imaging. You know, we as radiologists have the potential to make a huge difference in the diagnosis and management workup of these patients.
Thank you so much to Lalani Carlton-Jones for recording that readful discussion with Frank. That was an awesome update. So many things I've taken away from that. Too many to discuss in the outro, to be honest.
Does that mean, Dixon, that for once we don't need to fill dead air with random goats and meat updates? And
some would argue that we should never fill random air with goats and meat updates. But this reminded me, like with our recent readful on uterine fibroid embolization, this is another example of where management options have evolved and where a lot of patients around the world are being suboptimally managed.
Yep.
And so keeping our article up to date, spreading the word via the podcast, I think is really important. I know in addition to Lalani, there are a whole bunch of passionate radiologists around the world working and publishing in the area of CSF leaks. And I think they deserve a whole lot of credit
for
the rapid evolution in knowledge in this area. And I think it's going to improve many, many people's lives.
It was definitely actually a wake-up call for me, because I kind of go through life assuming that because I work at a teaching hospital, I do a reasonable amount of reading of journals and certainly do a fair bit of learning around the edges, that I would naturally keep up with all of this. But somehow the whole CSF leak fistula topic kind of bypassed me. I knew that they existed, but I didn't really understand how frequent they were, how the imaging strategy should change, and all of that. So you have to actively try and stay up to date. It's not something that happens just passively.
I've been aware of it, particularly through Twitter and conferences, but it's one of those ones where for quite a few years I've been saying, oh, we really need someone in our department to take this on board and to be the person who deals. I'm like, I don't have the time. I'm too busy running a conference and all these other things, but we really need somebody who's going to step up and be that person, because I know that the management that we're providing, and we're starting to do it now, has been suboptimal for many years.
Absolutely.
I've written so many points here, but I'll just pick out a couple. Firstly, the hydrostatic indifference point. I'm not sure about this concept, actually, Gaylord. I must say I'm a little indifferent.
Oh, God.
That's all. I just wanted to make a joke. No, actually, I think it makes a whole lot of sense. You know, the symptoms are in the head where the pressure is low, but the leak is in the spine. A skull-based leak is not going to cause the headache and the same kind of symptoms.
Yeah, so for me, the indifference point, which is just to refresh that bit of idea, is the point where the pressure is the same when you're lying and standing, is in some way less conceptually important than realizing that when you're standing the column of CSF, since there's no valves or anything, there's a huge pressure gradient from much higher in the sacral cul-de-sac and negative intracranially. And so that makes a lot of sense as to why when you're standing, negative pressure means CSF doesn't squirt out. If anything, that's why bugs get in and you get meningitis, right? Whereas it only leaks out when you strain or bend over. And it's actually, I've spoken to a number of my colleagues about this, you know, base of skull CSF leaks don't cause intracranial hypotension. And I've had quite a bit of pushback from them, even though the literature all sort of supports that. We all feel as if we've seen this, but actually thinking back, I don't remember finding CSF base of skull leaks with craniospinal hypotension in the past.
No, it's usually rhinorrhea or something like that.
Yeah, that's right.
Another thing I wanted to do was just summarize the three main types, Gaylord, because repeating it is going to help me remember it, even if it doesn't help the listeners. So the type one CSF leak is that dural tear, usually ventral, usually from like a calcified disc protrusion in the upper thoracic spine. And the type two is a lateral leak from a meningeal diverticulum, often in the lower thoracic spine. And these type one, type two are usually in younger adult patients. Whereas the type three, which is that increasingly recognized, probably a lot more common than we think, is the CSF venous fistula. And these do coexist with a diverticulum, and they're usually middle-aged to older patients.
Right. And it's that last one, the CSF venous fistula, that is particularly tricky to identify, particularly if you don't go looking for it.
Yeah.
Your chances of identifying it by not doing specific investigations is basically zero.
Yeah. So imaging-wise, Frank, the brain MRI to look for signs of hypotension, pretty straightforward. MRI spine to look for an epidural collection. I noticed that the term SLEC, spinal longitudinal epidural collection, didn't specifically come up in the discussion. That's the term that's used, though, for it, right?
It's definitely a term that is used. And yes, lots of CSF in the epidural space, not just in one little pocket.
Yeah. So if you see a SLEC ventrally, then it's likely a dural tear from a calcified disc protrusion or a lateral leak from a meningeal diverticulum. But this is the important bit. If you see no epidural fluid, no collection, then that's when you're likely to be dealing with a CSF venous fistula. Yep. And that will inform the next test that you do. And it seems like dynamic CT myelogram at the moment is kind of where it's at, right? We did one at the Alfred just a few weeks ago and found a CSF venous fistula. I must say, though, that there were probably three or four quite long-range scans of the spine performed during it. And the fellow was in the room, right? He's injecting the contrast as the scan's being performed. And because, you know, of the location where he needs to be to inject, the radiation position was not optimal. Did Lal mention anything about the technical side of things and radiation safety in your chat?
We did talk about that. Didn't make it into the edited version. But like many procedures, there's a steep learning curve. And initially, you have to accept that your doses are going to be higher than they will be eventually. Just recently in AJNR, I think at the end of last year or a few months ago anyway, there was an article describing using bolus tracking on the contrast column as you inject it to trigger the first scan to make sure you don't trigger too late or too early. So these sort of techniques are evolving. And when you combine that with ever lowering doses generally in CT, I think that is not as big an issue as it really is. When you compare it to how devastating the outcomes are of not identifying these, the worst thing you can do is do some tests and not get an answer.
Yeah. Which is what we've probably been doing a lot of the time in the past, right? At least this test makes the diagnosis.
Well, that's right. So there it's the radiation dose divided by diagnosis is sort of an infinitely bad return on investment if you do some scans but don't get a diagnosis.
Yeah. And the one we did beautifully show at one level a CSF venous fistula. Yeah. That was on the first study, so we did it like on the right side down or something. And then they came back a few days later to do the second side. I assume there must be a high rate at which there's more than one CSF venous fistula.
Yeah, so I think this is an area that is still sort of being looked into because often people stop when they find one. So the incidence of bilateral or multiple CSF fistulas is not necessarily known and is probably underreported. But that is something that Lani was talking about. You really kind of do need to look at both. I think of it in a similar sort of way to dural arteriovenous fistulas, where the fistula can be in many places. And just because you find one feeder doesn't mean you stop there because you only treat one, you haven't done very much.
And a few final little things I've written down here. No need to go into details, but I appreciated the discussion of those cases where the subdural hematomas have been drained, but the underlying diagnosis of hypotension has been missed. So make sure we think about that. The discussion of superficial siderosis I found fascinating. Also, the frontotemporal brain sagging syndrome as a reversible cause of cognitive impairment. So these are just, you know, other little things that I'll take away from that discussion.
Yeah, and that last one is particularly important because not all patients have headache and not all patients will have florid hypotensive signs on MR, particularly if you don't give contrast. You may walk past it if you're not sort of alert to it. And so you really worry about how many people out there are being treated or have been given a diagnosis of frontotemporal degeneration where they've got a reversible cause. It's a bit frightening, actually.
So frightening. Sorry, I was just trying to do some YouTube reactions for that, for that one. I forgot that was supposed to be what I was doing in the outro. But no, thanks again to Lalani and to you, Frank, for recording that. We better wrap this episode up. How can people get in contact with us?
Well, we're on at Radiopedia on X and Instagram, as well as at Frank Gaylard and at Dr. Andrew Dixon. And you can, of course, email us at podcast@radiopedia.org with any ideas and or feedback or your own React To podcast.
Yes. Yeah, you can react to our podcast.
Yeah.
Have you become indifferent to the podcast or are you enjoying what we've been leaking out over the last few episodes? Let us know. So good. And if you want to help support Radiopedia, then you can become a paid supporter via the website or purchase an all-access pass to our online courses and conference. In doing so, you'll be helping us to give free conference access to people in 125 low- and middle-income countries. And what and else you can people also... do to help us out? Frank, you always talk over me here.
And you can also help us out by volunteering to edit our podcast.
Oh, that's good. I like it. Yep.
Or if you can't do that, then you can at least leave us a 5-star review in the podcast app of your choosing.
Indeed. All right. And we'll catch you all again sometime soon in the reading room. I'm going to New Zealand for a couple of weeks, Gaylord. So I'll see you after that.
Hanging with the hobbits.
But this episode's pre-recorded in the can, so it won't stop the episodes coming. Even though I'm away for 2 weeks. People don't need to know that. But, you know, I'm going to New Zealand.
Just personal details.
Yeah.
That's right. Just give us the exact dates and your home address. And then, people can come and avail themselves of all your high-tech goodies.
And then last episode we said we're going to play pickleball, so we need to do that as well.
Maybe by the time this goes out, we already have.
The outro music is not going to cover this. Like, it's not long enough to cover this whole little bit. Have you even said stay rad yet?
Not yet. Not yet. Maybe I won't. Do you know those hidden tracks on LPs where there's 10 minutes of silence?
You can't say LPs in an episode where we've been talking about lumbar punctures.
Stay rad, everyone. Stay rad. Bye-bye.
See you when I get back.